appreciate those songs you selected, Brother TJ, and good to sing with the saints together. This morning, I decided to take another step further in the series in Job, and after this lesson, we should have one more left, and we will be complete in our series. God's wisdom was seen in the wild. And now in the next two chapters, God's wisdom is seen in the large and in charge of the wild. I've titled this one, God's Power Greater Than the Dinosaurs. These terrible beasts, coined by the name dinosaurs in 1841, are described next in the text. And is it any surprise that this becomes the culmination of God's speech? After God talks about these fantastic beasts, he has no more left to say, and no more is needed to be said. Now, if you think about God's speech to Job, God had described the things that Job could see in the sky and beyond, and how God made all of that Job could see work by his wisdom. And then God focuses on his wisdom that he has shown in the surrounding land animals that he takes care of and provides for, the abundant animal life that surrounds man. And now among those creatures upon earth, there are none more impressive than the dinosaurs. And we know, it's a matter of fact, that man lived concurrent with the dinosaurs. You just have to study Genesis chapter 1 and see that that's the case of the days of creation. Man and animals, day 5 and day 6. Now, I must admit, having seen the fossils and visited the numerous museums and been impressed by the magnificent creatures, the dinosaurs, it would seem strange to me if God never mentioned these creatures that he made in the Bible. Now, some feel that that is the case, and they're happy to exclude them from the Bible. But it only makes sense that if God did, in fact, create these creatures in Genesis 1, and he did, that he also somewhere mentioned them in the Bible. And he does. He does in spectacular fashion, and none more descriptive of a place than these two chapters here in Job 40 and Job 41. But before he describes the two dinosaurs, he first has a question for Job. And so let's begin there. Now, remind yourself that he had asked Job a question at the beginning of his speech, right? The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man, and I will question you, and you shall answer me." So God then begins his speech to Job. And now, in essence, you have him in chapter 40, verses 1 through 5, saying, "Now what do you have to say about it, Job?" So look there in Job 40 and verse 1. "Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, 'Shall the one who contends with the Almighty correct him? He who rebukes God, let him answer it.'" What does Job say? Verse 3, "Then Job answered the Lord and said, 'Behold, I am vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand over my mouth.'" You see, Job was guilty trying to steer God aright, as if God could be wrong. Job felt strongly that he was innocent of his suffering, which he was. But he incorrectly concluded it was because God found fault in him. God never did, or said that he did. In fact, it was the opposite. God actually said, "Do I have any other servant like the servant Job? I don't think that there's one like him. There's none like Job on all the rest of the earth." That's what God concluded of Job in chapter 1. So Job was way off in his conclusions. And as the days turned into weeks and perhaps months, Job felt more and more sure about his conclusions. And so that his tone change towards God. Tone, which I always say to the kids is vitally important when you talk to your parents, your tone. Job's tone became more accusatory and justified and matter of fact, so that he comes across as if he's correcting God. And so he sins with his mouth. Don't forget, how you say, what you say, means as much as was as actually said. Don't forget that. Job gets it. Job gets it. And in verse 4, he says, I'm vile. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. Verse 5, once I have spoken, but I will not answer. Yes, twice, but I will proceed no further. I get it. He says, I've sinned. I've sinned with my mouth. I will not speak again to correct you. I will double close my mouth with my lips and with my hands. I was so wrong. Now please note, so far in God's speech to Job, nowhere does God say, now Job, here's the reason why you suffered. You see, you were righteous, and I always loved you, and I was always with you, but Satan wanted to accuse you to see if you really, really did love me. And so that's why this whole thing happened, Job. God never, ever says that to Job. Job never gets that kind of response at all. All he's gotten from God so far was God speaking about his wisdom and glory, seen in the heavens, seen in everything around him, and telling Job, asking Job the questions, you know, who created these things? Who implanted the wisdom that you see in these things? Where were you when that happened? You were nowhere around, were you, Job? So Job, you are simply learning that your suffering is just one thing of many things, many, many things that you do not understand, but I do. And like everything, I do things for a reason, Job. You see, God has his reasons. He's always had his reasons. Even when, listen now, even when the perfect man, the sinless man, Jesus Christ, died such a terrible death, undeserving of such a death, you better believe it, God had his reasons, didn't he? Thank God for that reason. Now, people may learn it, people may not learn it, but it doesn't take away from the fact that God had his reasons. So God gives Job one more object lesson. This one was impressive. Job, that was risky of you to try and correct me. You don't have the power to do that. Do you have an arm like God? No, you don't. So he begins there in verse 6 of chapter 40. Would you annul my judgment? Look there, verse 6. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, now prepare yourself like a man, and I will question you, and you shall answer me. Would you indeed annul my judgment? Would you condemn me that you may be justified? Have you an arm like God? You see, Job, you stopped talking, but you asked a whole lot of questions beforehand. Now, it's not wrong to ask questions, but remember, what did I say? The tone in which Job was at. He was an accusatory tone towards God. Now, God, in essence, is saying, I'm going to ask you questions, and they're going to be accusatory too, but I'm going to be right in doing that. You're going to know my judgment, Job? You're going to condemn me so that you'd be justified? You see, the way you said things, it was as if you condemned me. Now, nowhere, we've read it, we've studied the book of Job, right? Nowhere did Job say the words, God, I condemn you, right? It was his accusatory tone that did it. Now, I'm going to go back to the kids on this one again. You don't have a right to use that tone with your parents. You ever heard your parents say that before? You may have wondered, why is that? You might use that tone with me. Well, look here. You're seeing the answer to that. You're seeing here in Job and God, there's one that's above the other in terms of authority, in terms of right, in terms of power, right? And you don't have, as a subordinate, the right to accuse one in your tone, one that is above you in terms of authority. That is true in regard to the parent-child level, right? Ephesians 6:2, children, honor your parents. That's what it says. You don't read of a verse the other way around. And so there's a way in which you approach your parents, the way in which you talk to your parents that is vitally important. It's also true from just a younger person to an older person. That's what Paul told Timothy, right? A younger man. He said, do not rebuke an older man, but rather address him as a father, right? The same is true in civil authority. Accuse a judge at a court and see how that works for you. Just be accusatory in your tone towards them. It ain't going to work. How do you address the judge? Your what? Your honor. See that? That's his place of authority. Tone. And why am I emphasizing? Because I'm seeing it more so. You know, you get teenagers and they all of a sudden they think they're on the same level sometimes, right? You can see this more in the world surrounding you. The way that they talk to their teachers. The way they talk to their parents. As if they have a right to do that. To be sarcastic, snarky, or rude. Let me tell you, that's sinning with your mouth like Job did. You're out of place when you're doing that to one who's of a higher authority than you. It's why Peter had said in his letter, honor the king and the governor. Right? Those in authority, he said. It's why Paul even apologized when he lacked such to the high priest and he's quickly put in his place by a guard. See, God does not take this lightly from Job. And recall this about Job. I'm going to remind you about this about Job. Job was up there in terms of humankind. He wasn't a nobody. He was the best and the wisest of the East. No one blameless like Job. None like him in all the earth, God said. But next to God, when he was compared next to God, Job was way, way, way down the ladder. The bottom rung. Beneath the bottom rung. Because there's none like God. That's why. Now imagine all the flack and the lip that Jesus Christ received while he was on earth. You know, he was right on the cross when he said, Father, forgive them. They do not know what they do. They really did not know who they were talking to. Now again, I'm spending a long time on this because it really sets the scene for the dinosaurs and the terrible lizards on earth, as you'll see. Here were beasts that if treated without authority or lightly would crush you, Job. So what do you think God would do to you? See? That's why God brings this up. Look there, verse 9. Have you an arm like God? Or can you thunder with a voice like His? No. Right? Verse 10. Then adorn yourself with majesty and splendor and array yourself with glory and beauty. Disperse the rage of your wrath. Look on everyone who is proud and humble him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together. Bind their faces in hidden darkness. Then I will also confess to you that your own right hand can save you. You see that? Just try and do what I can do. You have no power comparison to mine, Job. None. You can't even have power over yourself. But here's the problem. You have spoken, you have accused as if you had a choice. As if you possessed the power to do something about it before me. Well, let's talk about your power. Let's compare it to some other things on earth, Job. Let me jog your memory about the great behemoth there in verse 15. Look now at the behemoth, which I made along with you. He eats grass like an ox. So God addresses his attention to the behemoth, which he said, I made with you. It's almost as if God knew the future. That many commentaries would allegorize and symbolize this text, saying there really wasn't such a creature. Or it's just all poetry, they say. Yet of all the animals in the previous chapter, right? The eagle, the lion, the ostrich. They never say that about those. All the descriptions given about them were accurate of those animals, weren't they not? But God, who knows the future, puts to rest all such arguments with a simple statement as this, the behemoth which I made along with you. See, I made it like I made you. It was a real beast. And God paralleled its reality to the reality that there was a Job. To deny one is to deny the other. To spiritualize the one is to spiritualize the other. Now I know some poetic license is used from time to time. When he talks about the bones like beams and of bronze and ribs like bars of iron, as we'll notice in just a minute, he was not saying the bones were literally metal, but that it was like it. Describing some strong, large bones. God made the dinosaurs, which have captivated the minds and imaginations of men all over this globe. And you find evidence of them, fossils all over this globe as well. Again, it would be an odd thing to think we would never read of them in the Bible. But God, who knows who we are, he knows our frame, he knows how we think, what we're amazed by, it is then no surprise that we find them in his book, especially at a time when it would be most appropriate to convince Job of his might and power that made the most powerful and mighty creatures known to man. Now, what is this creature? The behemoth, as we read the descriptions, most likely fit what we call today a brachiosaurus or an apatiosaurus. If it's one of the largest that we know of, it might be like a supersaurus or a seismosaurus, which could be 130 to 170 foot long. Let's imagine. It's amazing. From the Bible descriptions, you're going to see why this could be the case. Look there in verse 16. See now his strength is in his hips, and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. He is the first, that is the chief or the biggest of the ways of God. Only he who made him can bring near his sword. See, he describes this beast with a tail like a tail of a tree. Now you have some that will say in their commentary, you might even have a marginal note, or if you have a study Bible, a marginal note there that says this was the hippopotamus. I guarantee you, if you look at the tail of a hippopotamus, you would not say, look, it's like a cedar tree. More like a branch or a broom. That's what that was. But this animal here, its tail was like a cedar tree. Its bones like beams of bronze. And you can, like I said, go to some of the museums and see these massive skeletons. Most of them are models. Every now and then they have a rare find. But they're amazing, amazing creatures. You can see why God would say they're the chiefest of ways of God, the biggest, the tallest ways of God. You see the little human being down there at the bottom? I'll zoom in there for you. Look at that. It's almost as if the rib cage would fall on top of her. She'd be captured within a jail cell. Like beams of bronze. Ribs like bars of iron. See, this fits the description of this creature. Job was an eyewitness to this creature. Verse 20 says, surely the mountains yield food for him, and all the beasts of the field play there. With his long neck, he could reach as high as if to the mountains to be able to eat. Now, he was a plant eater. Verse 21, he lies under the lotus tree in a covert of reeds and marsh. The lotus tree cover him with their shade. The willows of the brooks surround him. So he likes shade and vegetation. Being a plant eater, he makes his home with the trees. And it's like its vegetable garden. Verse 23, indeed the river may rage, yet he's not disturbed. He is confident, though the Jordan gushes into his mouth. He's not afraid when the rapids rise and they start to flood. It cannot move him. He just opens up his mouth and drinks the water that comes his way. Verse 24, though he takes it in his eyes, or one pierces his nose with a snare, a trap would merely be like a nose piercing. He's just too large for man to trap by himself. So this is one amazing creature, behemoth. And again, why does God use it? Remember verse 9? Have you an arm like God? He's talking about his strength. I made the beast that you have no chance against. Yet you would dare contend with me as if you can correct me? See, Job could relate to this, having walked among the dinosaurs in his day. And it would be a great point that God made only if Job actually knew this creature that God was talking about. Otherwise, God misses his point with Job, right? No, Job knew. And that's why God uses a reference point that Job was aware of. Well, now in chapter 41, what about this other dinosaur? What about this other beast? God says of the Leviathan, can you stand against it? Good luck. Can you catch it? Try. Chapter 41, verse 1. Can you draw out Leviathan with a hook? Or snare his tongue with a line which you lower? Can you put a reed through his nose? Or pierce his jaw with a hook? The rhetorical questions. The answer was no. Job would know the answer was no. And so he continues on. Remember, God says, behave yourself, Job. I'm going to question you. I'm going to accuse you now of things. Verse 3. Will he make many supplications to you? Is this beast all just praying, oh, please, Job, don't capture me? No. Will he speak softly to you? Oh, I'll be nice, Job, right? No. See, God using the sarcasm of Job to make a point because God's in a position of authority. Verse 4, will he make a covenant with you? Will you take him as a servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you leash him for your maidens? Will your companions make a banquet of him? Will they apportion him among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hand on him, remember the battle, and look, never do it again. Indeed, any hope of overcoming him is false. Shall one not be overwhelmed at the sight of him? No one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? See, that's the point. I made this. You can't stand against that. So why would you think you can stand against me? Who has preceded me that I should pay him? Everything under heaven. Everything under heaven is mine. See, all those rhetorical questions, the answer is no, 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 and no again. I made that creature. I'm greater than it. But Job, you are not. You have no hope against it. Now, God continues in verse 12. I will not conceal his limbs, his mighty power, or his graceful proportions. Who can remove his outer coat? Who can approach him with a double bridle? Who can open the doors of his face with his terrible teeth all around? The idea is, Job, you can't catch him and turn him into a belt or some boots to wear. His terrible teeth are scary. Dinosaur means terrible lizard. And God had made this one with terrible teeth, he says. In verse 15, it says, his rows of scales are his pride, shut up and tightly, like a seal. One is so near another that no air can come in between them. So he's talking about the skin of this animal. It's thick. It's scaly, like chainmail armor. There's no gaps, no air in between them. They are joined, verse 17, one to another. They stick together. They cannot be parted. Sadly, again, some have concluded this is merely an alligator or a crocodile. You might look a marginal note, or you might have a study Bible that says something like that, or a commentary. But people overcome crocodiles and alligators all the time. There used to be a man called the Crocodile Hunter. And they turned them into boots and belts with great frequency. But not this creature. Truth be told, what we see being described here would be akin more to like what we might call a dragon. Do you know there's actually... this is a legitimate dinosaur fossil called the Draconex. Kind of see the word dragon similar because of its very facial-like features. Here's another angle of it as well. It's terrible teeth, and it would be fearsome to be able to see, no doubt about it. Oh, Stephen, but dragons, they can't be real. I mean, next thing you're going to tell me is that they breathe fire. Verse 18. His sneezings flash forth like light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lights. Sparks of fire shoot out. Smoke goes out of his nostrils as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame goes out of his mouth. Well, I didn't say it, but God sure did, didn't he? That he had a creature that out of his mouth went fire. Now you and I know that across this globe there are flood stories nearly in every ancient culture. Did you know that there's also dragon stories too? Now, we know the flood was a reality. And we'd say all those flood myths, those were based off of that reality. Why is one based off a reality but not the other? And since the word dinosaur wasn't invented until 1841, pray tell, what do you think they might have referred to terrible lizards as? Is it so hard to believe that they may have referred to them as dragons? In fact, if you have the old King James Version, you'll find that word in there quite often. Descriptive of a terrible monster, say a dragon. I'll give you one example if you want to hold your place in Job. Look in Jeremiah chapter 51. Jeremiah 51. In verse 34, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, has devoured me. He has crushed me. He has made me an empty vessel. He has swallowed me up like a dragon. If you have the King James Version, that's the Hebrew word tanin. The New King James translates it monster, but the Old King James before 1841 was translated dragon. He has filled his stomach with my delicacies. He has spit me out. Yes, I know truth is stranger than fiction sometimes. But sometimes fiction is based off of some form of truth. And it could be that man took the Leviathan and made more of it than he should. The dragon more than he should, right? Forming these fancy tales of how they could talk and how they loved to hoard gold, right? Like in Lord of the Rings or something like that. That's fiction. That's false. But could there not be a dragon-like creature? And if not, then does God miss the boat with Job, right? By describing a creature that Job never could have known, never could have been able to see. You know, look, I'm more powerful than this thing that you never know about, never seen, right? He would have missed the point. Job would have been able to make the comparison. He did know what this creature was. All of that because verse 10, no one is so fierce that he would dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand against me? See, that's what God's trying to get at. Well, let's keep reading the description in verse 22. Strength dwells in his neck, and sorrow dances before him. Verse 23. The folds of his flesh are joined together. They are firm on him and cannot be moved. His heart is as hard as a stone, even as hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid because of his crashings. They are beside themselves. When he raised himself up, here's a good passage to show that it can't be a crocodile, because when he raises himself up, he's just maybe 2 inches above the ground higher. He's got those short little legs, right? But not this creature. This creature can stand tall, you see? Everyone's afraid when he raises himself up. Well, continuing on, verse 26. Though the sword reaches him, it cannot avail, nor does spear, dart, or javelin. Again, people kill crocodiles and alligators all the time with some of those. Verse 27, he regards iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones become like stubble to him. Darts are regarded as straw. He laughs at the threat of javelins. His undersides are like sharp potsherds. Isn't that interesting? He spreads pointed marks in the mire. He makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. He leaves a shining wake behind him. One would think the deep had white hair. He's talking about how he's boiling the oceans in some ways, the water that's around him, right? As if the steam coming off the water like white hair. Verse 33, on earth there's none like him, which is made without fear. He beholds every high thing. So it can't be a short alligator. He is king over all the children of pride. God describes him as the humble maker, the pride killer. No one can stop him. He boils the water with his breath. He beholds every high thing. He is big and can rise up tall. Again, that is descriptive like what we might consider of a dragon. Now listen, I am not unaware that you look stupid if you say you believe in dragons of the past. And surely, much fiction and fantasy has come about that, like I said, is not true. But where does it not come from but from a kernel of truth? The creature Job knew, and everybody knew in Job's day, was a creature that created such fear in them. And you know what? People generally are impressed by things that they fear. They write about it. They dwell upon it. They think about it. Create stories about it. And so they did. So man did. But not God. He just tells the facts. Is it really too hard to believe so far-fetched? Let me tell you something that's far-fetched. We have evolutionists today that tell us that life came from non-life. That is far-fetched. That is it is impossible to believe that life came from non-life. You're kidding me, right? It is a million times easier to believe that dragons in the past existed than life came from non-life. But fire, really? Well, can God not create an eel that produces electricity? Could he do that? Oh, he did, didn't he? Yeah, he did. Could God create a bug that could create light? Oh, yeah, he did that too, didn't he? You see, there are chemical reactions that are within these, either the eel or the bug, that can create light or electricity. No one says that's crazy to believe that an animal could create electricity and light. What about the bombardier beetle? Is it crazy to believe that God created an insect that could shoot out streaming liquid, streaming hot, 212 degrees hot, that it vaporizes the air around it and creates smoke? If God did make those things, is it really such a stretch that he created such a particular dinosaur that could breathe fire that is now extinct. You know, there's other witnesses in history besides the Bible. Did you know this? Are every one of them wrong too? There are some stories from the ancient past. One from ancient Babylon, dating 2000 BC. Gilgamesh is told to have encountered a huge, vicious dragon. Alexander the Great in 330 BC found some in India worshiping a huge reptile-like creature that lived in a cave. In the UK alone, there are dragon legends found in all of these towns listed on the chart. You find legends like this all over the globe. England and several other cultures have retained the story of St. George, who slew a dragon that lived in a cave. There's so many records of dragons. Here's Pliny the Elder in his book Natural History, 70 AD. He said, Africa produces elephants, but it is India that produces the largest as well as the dragon. He just kind of talks about it in passing. We're talking about elephants. Africa makes some good ones, but India makes the best ones. Oh, and they also have the dragons there too. See? Just like it was understood. Marco Polo said the Chinese emperor also had imprisoned some himself. You know China and their art, renowned for their dragon stories. You know, one of the oldest calendars we have is the Chinese calendar. It is 4,700 years old. It has 12 pictures of animals to represent the 12 months of the year. Every time you go to a Chinese restaurant, you might get handed one of these as your little mat to eat your food upon. Did you notice something? All of those are animals that we know and still have around today, except one. Top right-hand corner. Dragon. Are we led to believe that all of those are real except just the one? Again, when was the calendar made? 4,700 years ago. When man walked the earth with the dinosaurs. Further, you might note that it's distinguished from the snake, right? If the dragon is completely mythical, one would have thought that at least one other mythical creature might have been included on their calendar. I'm thankful that there is some that create material that is for those that believe in creation and the creation account in Genesis. And even try to help our children. Here's a coloring page that one of my children colored. Of Leviathan, a representation of it. Perhaps the Leviathan of Job 41 looked much like this. And so that can help counterbalance some of the evolution that maybe that they're often so taught in schools today, which is that man and dinosaur never coexisted, that they were separated by millions and millions and millions of years from one another. Job 40 and Job 41 stand as a testament against that very thing. The sheer volume of legends around the world is a strong corroboration of the Bible record to the reality of the dinosaurs sharing the earth with mankind. The amount of evidence is so staggering in terms of what is shared in history that even one of the most famous evolutionists of our time, Carl Sagan, cannot deny the fact. He said, "The implacable mutual hostility between man and dragon, as exemplified in the myth of St. George, is strongest in the West, but it is not a Western anomaly. It is a worldwide phenomenon." Even he could not deny the fact that there is so many legends and representations all over the world, because man and dinosaur did coexist. And man feared dinosaur, as Job did, and man would often write about the things they fear. God used this so that he might remember, that Job might remember to fear God and keep His commandments. For this is man's all. God made them as He made us. It's just a fact, as He told Job, I made the behemoth along with you. And we're impressed even today, even though they're extinct, right? And we visit museums or we go to Dinosaur World just down the street. We use our imagination of what it must have been like to walk amidst the dinosaurs like Job did. The next chapter is the final chapter. And you will see a changed Job. And it's important to point out that Job is changed by God's chastening. And Job is changed after, not before, God reminds him of the most powerful beast known to man, the dinosaurs. And how even the beasts that put awe into the heart of man are infinitely weaker and smaller than their creator. Job is humbled, Job is restored, and Job has been disciplined by his struggle and by his God. You know, it's often not until we're disciplined that we do change. How did Jonathan Cowles, who confessed a month or so ago, change? Discipline. Discipline. See, when life goes on like normal, we forget God. But once discipline enters the picture, we change. The question is, do you change for the better? Do you seek after God? I'm thankful Job did, and he would change for the better, but not until after he was disciplined by God. And so, friends, see the blessing in disguise and grow from him. You will find him, for he is not far from any one of us, the Bible says. Maybe you're here this morning, you're not a child of God. Repent of your sins, confess faith in Christ, be baptized, be plunged in the waters of baptism for the forgiveness of your sins, and he'll cleanse you and make you whole. If, as God's child, you've forsaken Him, and maybe there's been a disciplining element in life that you've had to experience, we're sorry that you've had to experience it. But let there be a silver lining to the cloud. Trust in God, return back to Him, and He will save you. Won't you come while we stand and sing? I have decided to follow Jesus. I have decided to follow Jesus. I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back, no turning back.